I'm Eric Chu. I am a last semester PhD student at MIT Department of Urban Studies and Planning. The paper, the chapter, is really based on some exploratory work for my dissertation that I started back in late 2010 when I started at MIT. And the overriding question of my entire research project has always been, how do city governments in developing countries understand the impacts of climate change? How do they translate those mandates into what they're existingly doing? And what changes do you see in city governance, in city policymaking, and city planning in response to these emerging impacts? But also, a critical issue that I am really interested in is what are the impacts of external actors who are funding and supporting some of these adaptation efforts in city governments? The location that I talk about in this paper is India, where the bulk of my dissertation research is in. In the chapter itself, in the paper, I talk about three cities. So it's kind of a squeeze to talk about all three in one setting. So I'm just going to try to run through some of these cases, but really focus on the policy implications that kind of emerge from looking at these cities and studying these cities for almost 5 years now. Here are some pictures, some of the initial impacts of extreme events that some of these cities really cite as motivations for adaptation planning. The three cities that I talk about are Bhubaneswar in eastern Orissa, Surat in western Gujarat, and Indore in the central state of Madhya Pradesh. And all three are fairly different cities in terms of what kinds of impacts will occur. Surat, for example, is really interested in protecting the city against floods, for example. The interior city of Indore is really water-stressed and has issues with maintaining their water infrastructure in drought seasons, for example. But the one common thread is that all three cities have a long history of receiving external support. The organization that I followed most for the past 5-6 years is actually the Rockefeller Foundation. As many of you probably know, one key program in Indian cities is the Asian Cities Climate Change Resilience Network, ACERN, which has concluded, but is one of the major motivators and funders of adaptation and resilience efforts in Indian cities. And a lot of cities cite either Rockefeller as the primary kind of, I don't want to use donor, but it kind of is, in supporting their resilience and adaptation programs such as Surat and Indore, and cities like Bhubaneswar, who see those pilot cities like Surat and Indore as additional motivators, as kind of policy diffusion issues where they're learning from these pilot cities, but kind of planning as they go along. So the scene, just to quickly set the scene here, this is exploratory work where I really focus on public sector institutions in these three cities, looking at what kinds of governance mechanisms are kind of being changed or being used, really focusing on things like plan making mechanisms, kind of inclusion mechanisms, participatory processes, budgeting mechanisms, and kind of the more kind of mundane things like physical planning, like looking at a lot of maps, looking at a lot of plan strategies and policies and white papers and all that come out. I won't kind of talk a lot about what climate adaptation is because that's not needed. But here are the three cities just to briefly kind of map those out as I was talking about them. And just really to talk about some of the findings that I kind of highlight in the chapter itself. The chapter in the discussion is divided into three parts, looking at motivations for adaptation planning, which is a key stream of research that our research group at MIT really kind of talks about, looking at some of those inclusive participatory processes that came out, and also looking at some of those physical concrete outcomes that came out of the planning processes. as you can see here, three sets of photographs from three cities are really kind of the outputs and outcomes of Rockefeller projects, of UNDP projects, of AID projects that have happened in some of these cities, but with local flavors, I guess. The question I asked before is these external funds seemingly uniform in the sense that it really is just a guideline of what cities should do, what vulnerability assessments should include. So what accounts for some of these diverse outcomes at the end? Why do cities, when faced with some of these this money, which they're often very eager to accept, and these kind of external actors often hiring local consultants, how do these kind of mandates and recommendations get translated into what you see on the ground today? And one of the key arguments in the paper is that, yes, there are a lot of these external motivators and incentives that come in, but when it comes down to it, it's really, cities are really translating some of these external mandates using some of the more mundane, what later gets framed, not in this paper, but later in my dissertation, gets framed as the mundane artifacts of urban governance. What you're seeing is that climate change adaptation, though there is a lot of uncertainty and kind of issues with projections and issues of sustainability of funds, are really getting integrated into city governments in a way that cities are starting to take ownership of how the message is framed. And in the paper, the frame that I focus on is the issue of co-benefits here. Obviously, cities are, a lot of times, are resource constrained to some degree. Surat, for example, is considered in the Indian context as a high capacity city. But you do see, for example, when Rockefeller came in and said, oh, well, we're gonna give you some resources to do a vulnerability assessment, and the results came out and said public health is an issue because they have a history of public health issues, public health disasters, I guess, because plague, they did experience that at some point 15 years ago. And things like river flooding, those you should really just plan for. And we're going to give you some money to do some pilot projects. And what occurred was that they did come up with an early warning system. They did kind of reinforce some of those flooding infrastructures to prevent backlogs, and for example, like that. But in order to gain acceptance in the city political sphere and to gain awareness with the populace, it was the adaptation framing kind of got lost. And you saw this bridging between sectors and bridging between vulnerable populations and private capitalists, in this case of Surat, as a really key driver in translating this external adaptation mandate into something that you see 5 years later on the ground. And there are pros and cons with this kind of framing, this co-beneficial framing. A very glaring one is what happens to marginalized communities at the end that the assumption is that they have a lower voice in this process. And in Surat, you do see that. You do see private industrialists and business, I mean, not necessarily kind of on purpose, but you do see them overriding the process a little bit and seeing things like water flooding infrastructure protecting the more economically valuable assets. But having said that, there is conscious effort to kind of gain civil society inclusion in some of these planning processes and in the outcomes. And these are some pictures from, the one on the right is from Indore, where I lived in a slum for about 3 months following a women's group around that have taken taken is the right word, Rockefeller seed money, and really just developed a community-based water management, water management system within their neighborhood. and have framed adaptation really as a response against long-term water stress. And you do see, I ask them questions like, so what do you do when there's extreme events? What do you do? And their vocabulary when talking about climate change, a lot of times because of Rockefeller influence and others, are starting to really talk about climate change a little bit. When I first started back in 2010, it was just not part of the vocabulary. And it was very difficult to ask them questions about this. But when you really observe what they're doing, they're already doing autonomous responses against some of these emerging impacts because they are feeling it. What Rockefeller really added was the vocabulary of climate change and climate stress. And really kind of just like, oh my God, somehow it clicked within this particular group at least. What we're seeing in the past 10, 15 years, oh, this is climate change. And finally we have a name for it. Finally we have a source of money for it. And finally we have people who are dedicated to come in, like me, who actually go in and ask them and pester them. But also seeing other aid agencies come in and say, this is an issue, and we're gonna support kind of further projects that you're doing in this sphere. The picture on the left there is a hazard response team, a volunteer team in Bhubaneswar, because the city does experience a lot of cyclones. This team, some of the training modules are funded by the Red Cross and also UNDP. So you're starting to see people come in and really kind of agglomerate, I guess, around issues of climate change, even though sometimes they're not framed exactly like adaptation, because adaptation is so difficult to define. And the local context of how adaptation and risk reduction and vulnerability manifests very differently. So you see this variety of adaptation and vulnerability reduction in a lot of different contexts, in a lot of different ways. And it's really interesting to see how these projects come up kind of even with the same idea of adaptation and seeing the variety kind of underneath it. I guess I'll talk about the constraints a little bit later, just because I think I'm running low on time. But just kind of key issues that I've raised already is issues of participation, injustices in representation, but also in the distributional impacts of some of the adaptation physical infrastructure, adaptation infrastructures that are being put in. Issues of mainstreaming adaptation and development, particularly in terms of financing and budgets. There is a very strong push to integrate adaptation and vulnerability issues into city budgets. And cities are finding it very difficult, I think is the right way, to understand how adaptation, this broad and cross-sectoral, translates into line items on a budget. But you do see cities like Surat, Indor, Bhubaneswar inserting that those issues into their city budgets. And because Rockefeller money has ended, so the push for sustaining some of these programs, for them it really needs to be internal, to have internal champions, internal institutional leaders, but also the policy instruments behind it to continue when Rockefeller and AID actually leave. So some issues. So just to kind of wrap up some of these issues very quickly, this exploratory research, the motivation behind it is really to try to understand how adaptation manifests on the ground. I've been on IPCC for a couple years now, and the one complaint that I always have is adaptation is very theoretical. It's when you talk about resilience, you draw these Venn diagrams and you draw these really complex issues. But at least at the IPCC level, we didn't spend a lot of time understanding what people were actually doing. We're always like, well, people should do this. It's climate impacts, and there's uncertainty. What, 2 degrees, 4 degrees? But cities should transform what they're doing to account for these impacts. And for us, when I ask, what does that really mean? I don't really understand. Like, what are these pathways? What are these mechanisms for change? It's really unclear. But in the 2014 IPCC, there we did have some conscious effort to try to catalog what this means. And in chapter 14, the chapter that I am in, Adaptation Needs and Options, we started to build a table of what adaptation needs and options, what those really looked like. And so this the motivation behind, this is one motivation behind trying to empirically document what is actually happening. So Rockefeller is really interested in some of these issues because they funded a lot of these things for a long time, and they're still going to in a different kind of 100 resilient cities frame, but they really want to account for what happened. And given the experimenting and the innovations that are occurring at the ground level, how does this actually upscale to and be replicated to different cities? Yeah, I'm showing all these diverse adaptation projects, but how does this kind of women's group-led water management system get transferred into a different context where there's also a women's group, but the awareness is not there, or the leadership is not there, or the initial seed money is not there? How do we actually understand the diffusion of these adaptation innovations across cities and not just the three that I listed here? Actually, the punchline, well, not one of the three punchlines, I guess, is so how does the transformation that the higher policy level people always ask for, how do those occur when adaptation on the ground is operationalized using some of these mundane tools of day-to-day urban governance? How do kind of incremental budget changes in budget or incremental integration of adaptation vocabulary into their 5-year city development plans and all these little things that cities are already doing, how do you understand how socioeconomic transformation, when we're talking about climate change, really fits into this day-to-day governance and kind of day-to-day operational framework that cities are constrained to follow because they do have a legislative mandate of providing services and infrastructure, and they do have budget cycles, they do have electoral cycles where climate change doesn't fit in. So this builds towards maybe some more publications in the future as trying to understand and trying to answer some of those questions that I raised. But yeah, so I think that's it for me. Yeah.